Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Sarah Henderson, I represent the four appellants in this case, the remaining individual defendants in this case that was filed back in 2020. The underlying case, obviously, as you've read in the briefs, is a cold case homicide of Leah Freeman back in 2000. Became cold for several years, and then eventually we have a prosecution that took place beginning in 2010. I want to start by taking a little bit of a hint from the two cases that you guys had scheduled back-to-back on the docket today, because I've been listening to some of the arguments recently and noticed that may be important. The thing that I noticed between the two briefings, at least on the clearly established qualified immunity arguments, was the issue of the lower courts taking the second prong of the analysis, that clearly established analysis, and defining it at much too high of a level of generality. And that was the connecting piece in this little sandwich of qualified immunity cases that became an open-faced sandwich when we submitted something on the briefs. So to that end, I want to make a little bit of an absurd statement, or it'll sound absurd. I want to talk about a case called Devereaux v. Abbey, which I'm sure that we're all very familiar with, a 2001 case out of the circuit. And what I want to say about it is that it is not a qualified immunity case. And that sounds silly. And the reason why I'm saying that is because as I'm analyzing the qualified immunity question, I sort of put these cases into two boxes. I either put them in the box of they're decided on whether a constitutional right exists at a high enough level that it's going to make it clearly established, in which case we're changing the landscape. Cases like Devereaux v. Abbey, while it seems to do that, it really does not do that. And the reason why is because in Devereaux v. Abbey, an opinion that I honestly love, and I think it was decided correctly, unfortunately, after correctly reciting the Supreme Court's analysis in Saucier v. Katz, where they laid out exactly the test that we're supposed to be doing, they correctly laid that out, and then immediately on the first prong of the analysis said, we find there is a clearly established right essentially not to have fabricated evidence or false evidence be used against you that was deliberately fabricated by the government. The problem with that is that that was not the clearly established prong. And that was really the only issue with that opinion, is because otherwise, if you take out the clearly established language from that first prong where it doesn't belong, otherwise it tracks the analysis perfectly, because it goes on to say, in the particular instances of this case, that is the actual conduct that these defendants on the evidentiary record could be said to have engaged in, that conduct they were not on notice could have been violative of someone's rights. And obviously in that case it was, you know, there's not a particular right to have an investigation into alleged sexual abuse be conducted a certain way, or to have the investigation or have the interviews be conducted a certain way. So in that circumstance, Devereaux got it right. They did the first prong, albeit including some problematic language that I think has permeated some of our decisions since then, particularly in the lower courts. But they did do the analysis correctly. And I think that's my big qualm with this case and why we're on appeal right now.
I'm worried that you're way into your argument time. Okay. And we need to talk about this case,
yes,
claim
absolutely.
By claim. So we know what Devereaux says. This isn't a case where I'm concerned about the clearly established prong about having a constitutional right to not have fabricated evidence used against you. But I just desperately need you to talk about this case.
Right.
So, claim by claim, please.
Absolutely. So our argument
let's get right into this case.
Yes,
let's take
absolutely.
Archer, for instance.
Yes.
With the fabrication of evidence. It appears that Archer's creation of the false narrative concerning the position of the deadly body and the beaten down vegetation patch would survive the first prong of this analysis.
That is what the district court found. Obviously,
I have a tough time trying to decide why those findings don't survive summary judgment.
Our argument as to why they should not survive summary judgment, Your Honor, is the fact that on the actual evidence presented to the court, the inference that those those statements were fabricated is completely contradicted by every piece of evidence in the record.
There you have it, the contradiction. So we really, we are here in an ordinary posture of an appeal on qualified immunity. But it seemed to me in your brief that you did acknowledge, and you don't dispute this general principle, that if the district court makes findings with respect to genuine issues of fact, that's not appealable at this stage. Do you agree with that?
It is not appealable to the extent that it is supported by the record. However, we have cited case law.
In general, the principle you agree with, but then you go on and, for example, in the opening brief, you say, Karcher did not fabricate the evidence regarding the position of the body. I don't know if he did or didn't, but you want to, the district court is saying, that in and of itself raises this factual issue. And you say, no, it really doesn't, because the evidence shows otherwise.
Well, am I missing something? But you seem to say that Scott v. Harris is your reason to do all of this. But Scott v. Harris really isn't this kind of a case. Scott v. Harris has a video. You can look at the video. You know what the video says. You know exactly what is there. You can see it. In this case, it seems to me that your arguments are really, well, I see this evidence differently than the district court did, so therefore the district court can't be right because there's no video saying how it can be viewed. It's all your view against what the district court says.
Well, it goes back to my question, which you haven't quite had a chance to answer yet, and that is, doesn't it boil down to these facts? This is, as Judge Smith points out about Scott v. Harris, the language used there is blatantly contradicted. I don't see how we have that in this case. So why isn't this the garden variety of he said, she said, varied facts? Unfortunately, we can't review that on an interlocutory basis.
I will answer that briefly, and I mean it, because in this case, we have photos. There are photos of the foliage in the record. There were photos at the autopsy taken. I mean, it's not exactly Scott v. Harris.
And what do the photos do for us?
And the photos, essentially, you can look at the photos and see that the description of the body is not incorrect in any way. However, go ahead.
So we don't have jurisdiction over sufficiency of the evidence. I will grant you this. There are times when there's a dispute of fact, and we get one of these interlocutory appeals, and what's really being appealed is whether the dispute of fact was material as a matter of law. Not every dispute of fact in a large murder investigation, there's going to be disputes, right? But the district court, and we have jurisdiction if we were appealing a materiality finding, maybe. It's pretty skinny. In general, our jurisdiction in this kind of an appeal is very thin. But I read your arguments much the way Judge McEwen reads them. You're really going to ask us to revisit the finding itself. We can't do that.
Putting aside the findings of the district court for a moment, I do really want to seize on your comment about materiality, because that is the second part of my two-part answer I really did want to get into. Materiality is huge, especially when it comes to Karcher. And the reason being, her descriptions of the scene, her descriptions of the body, even if we were to take the district court's conclusion that they were incorrect in some way, which obviously we dispute, but let's put that aside. The question remaining is what they have to do with Mr. McGuffin. They have absolutely nothing to do with him. It was undisputed that there was never any evidence found implicating him or anyone else in this murder, physical evidence that was located in that spot. So it doesn't matter. It would be the same thing as a description of a scene that later arguably turns out to be inaccurate in some way, even if that could be a constitutional violation, it would theoretically be a violation of every person's rights, because at that point, it bears no causal connection to the conviction of Mr. McGuffin particularly.
So you have statements in your opening brief about it's reviewable because it's blatantly contradicted. So I guess that's taking the Scott v. Harris language. But we don't have record sites on that. Where in the record do we look so we could say, oh, you're right, it is blatantly contradicted?
So in our opening brief, we actually laid out the actual testimony, what it was in the statement of facts with record citations that says, here's what the testimony actually was. Here's the testimony and the reports of everyone else who saw the same thing, just to make it clear as a factual matter, this is what took place so that we can accurately determine on this record, can we find a clearly established constitutional violation?
Okay, I'm going to move. You've pretty much answered my questions about Karcher. Now let's look at Oswald on the fabrication claim. It appears to me that the facts alleged about Oswald that he failed to collect and preserve evidence that he discovered alongside Freeman's left shoe. That's the best they have, I think. You're right? You agree?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, to me, that doesn't constitute a fabrication claim at all.
Agreed. Nor do I believe it establishes any constitutional violation, especially given the fact that...
We might think again about that when we get down to destruction of evidence. I mean, I'm just going to say there's at least something to say about it. Let's go to Schweniger. If we look at Schweniger, it seems as if Schweniger, and I'm trying to make sure I get this right, but it seems to me there's evidence that Schweniger knew that Bryant had access to information that would allow him to testify falsely. But I didn't see any evidence that Schweniger knew that Bryant would give false testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, never interacted with Bryant.
Or that he had any, there wasn't anything in the record to show he had knowledge of what Bryant said was false, even.
Correct, Your Honor.
And you agree with that?
I agree. It was a bit of a difficult argument to tackle, given the fact that there was nothing underlying it. We didn't have anything really to attack. It was like
the defendants disclosed that there had been this opportunity that he was very young at the time. Of course, it requires some time travel because it's 10 years earlier. But is the theory here that the defendants, I guess, and we're going to talk about Eric Schweniger, failed to disclose that Bryant had been in a position to hear this secondhand information from his stepfather and then perhaps was in a position to... It's hard on cross-examination to ferret out what he knew from firsthand experience from what he might have overheard if they didn't know that fact, that he was in proximity of his stepfather. I thought that was the theory here. Is that not right?
That was my understanding of the theory that was left after it became clear that there was no contact between these two individuals, this investigator. Yeah,
that wouldn't go under fabrication of evidence.
No.
That would have to go under one of the other claims.
It would have to be something under Brady. However, the fact that this individual, this witness, was the stepchild of the former case officer on the case was disclosed during the criminal prosecution. It's in what was disclosed.
Well, but I think the briefing makes it clear, if you look really hard, there's a place where that is mentioned. But I think the theory was that there was more to it than that, that he had, when the phone call was made by the in the cold case investigation, that they might want to check with Bryant. What wasn't disclosed is that he had been within the orbit of his stepfather to also have overheard details about the case, not just that there was the familial relationship. And I think that gist of the claim is that that wasn't disclosed. Do you think that was disclosed?
I believe it was. However, I think more importantly, at that point, we get back to what is it? What non-public information is Bryant supposedly to have heard we have no evidence of what that may be.
Well, okay. I don't see the record cite for what it's worth, but I do have a kind of related claim. I don't understand the factual theory, maybe for both lawyers, I'll tell you. I don't understand the factual theory for the destruction of exculpatory evidence claim against Schweniger.
To be frank, Your Honor, I don't either. I don't know. I believe there was an argument at some point that there was a note that Mr. Schweniger had created that was then handed off to the lead agency on the case, who was sort of gathering everything to be made available to the prosecutor and the defense. and that perhaps that note was not produced. However, we're going to have the same problem
as Zandi. If I look at this, it seemed that only Karcher really was tied fairly or unfairly to this, but none of the other appellants on this destruction of the evidence claim. Do you agree with that?
I would agree that the other three, that there's just nothing there for destruction.
However, what about the fact that Oswald had materials that he collected near the shoe as it relates to the destruction of the evidence, and they were lost?
The cigarette butt and the string and that evidence.
That strain is what I'm trying. It seems to me that survives the first prong in a destruction of evidence claim.
I would dispute that the idea that he collected evidence, turned that evidence in, then it was no longer in his possession.
Well, but
could possibly
just a minute,
back
that's
up
your
a claim
argument. That's your yeah. argument. Yeah. Their argument is he didn't turn it in. He collected it and didn't ever put it in there. That's their argument. I mean, and going back to fabrication of evidence, because I didn't get all the way through that.
Sorry.
The last one was Zanny. I'm trying to figure out what Zanny did. For fabrication of evidence, the best they have is that he located information he never gave anybody, right?
Correct. And I don't believe that claim has even survived our briefing. It was information that was arguably not produced, but it was in the DA's files. So it became a non-issue. It was something that was clearly produced to the prosecution.
I would turn to familial association.
Yes.
I want you to think about that. In your briefing, you say the alleged behavior in this case did not shock the conscience for the purposes of familial association. What cases do you rely on that?
Primarily,
I looked all over to find one.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that this is in the eye of the beholder, shock the conscience. It's kind of like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. Shock the conscience is not really something which, I mean, I see the facts. I see what they are. I'm trying to figure out how you're going to get me to go along with that. I mean, shock the conscience again seemed to be just like another argument where you're going to take a different position than the district court said. And I don't think that's a Scott argument. I think it's just your side of the view.
Well, so our argument, it boils down to, obviously, we recognize that there's now a circuit split between districts on whether or not essentially a derivative claim can be made for familial association.
Right.
So it's one thing to say that you've taken an action to violate a minor or a parent's right of familial association by directing your actions at that actual relationship versus a case where we have here, where in large part the claims are based on actions that were alleged to have taken place years before this child was even born. I mean, this child was not in utero. We don't have anything. And that's where sort of the common sense argument comes from with shocking the conscience, is that is the standard for a claim by Mr. McGuffin. So if we have a purely derivative claim by his as yet unborn child that none of these individuals have any reason to know exists, then that's what we have to prove. We have to prove not only that that's a cognizable claim, which we would argue is not, as is made clear by other circuits, and this circuit has recognized that split and that issue, but there's just not, we're having to shift the argument to what actual conduct are we talking about? And there's a disconnect.
Here you say that we have a split with other circuits, and then you cite, which we can't do anything about here as this panel, and then you cite Glucksberg. How does Glucksberg save you?
Let me really quickly jump back and make sure that I'm addressing your question, Your Honor. So Glucksberg is talking about the idea that the rights, substantive due process rights, to the extent that we're going to recognize them, they have to be sort of implicit rights that we've always sort of always agreed exist. And the problem we have is that the right that the Ninth Circuit recognized in Smith, an independent claim by a child for loss of companionship where there is no action that's directed at that familial relationship, doesn't, I was unable to find any textual support for the idea that that would be something just clearly implicit in our concepts of substantive due process.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm David B. Owens, here with Janice Perricallen, Andrew Larsdorf, and Mr. McGuffin. Mr. McGuffin was wrongfully convicted of a homicide he did not commit and spent 9 years imprisoned even though he was innocent. This suit followed Mr. McGuffin's exoneration, and this interlocutory appeal follows the denial of summary judgment.
First of all, let me say we feel badly about what happened to Mr. McGuffin.
I appreciate it.
There's no problem. We do. We honestly do. But we're stuck with now trying to deal with what the district court did on a summary judgment in regard to his case. And that's what we're stuck with. But we're not trying to put him down because we're asking these questions. And I hope you tell him that. That's not what we're doing. We're just trying to make sure the district court does the right thing. That's all we're trying to do.
Absolutely.
And I just wanted to put that right up front. I'd say give you 20 minutes again. All I'm trying to do is put that right up front to say that's not what we're after here. We understand it and we don't like it. But we're just trying to make sure the district court does the right thing.
I appreciate it.
So with the fabrication of evidence, my first question to you is, did the district court sufficiently separate out the analysis of these defendants as they should have on fabrication of evidence?
The answer is yes.
I'm having a tough time understanding how you could say that. I mean, the district court lumped them all together. It's kind of like they're a group. And because they're all a group, they're all fabricated, and there's where they are. I mean, I go to Karcher. I can find that Karcher created a false narrative concerning both position of the dead body and the beaten down vegetation. But I'm trying to figure out where does the district court say anything about what is the case that gives Karcher absolute notice that what Karcher did is wrong. Karcher, not the whole group, not a general overall, this is analysis, every time you fabricate evidence, you got a problem. What is it that really laid it into Karcher?
Your Honor, can I answer the first part? And before I come to Karcher about sort of the individualized analysis. So I think that one of the issues in this particular case is we have to take a step back. And this is a 62-page detailed decision following a voluminous record in which there were more than 10,000 pages of information submitted. You know, it's the defendant's burden at step one to show any entitlement that there's no genuine disputes of material fact in the case. And if you look back at the summary judgment motion that was filed here, there was no individual analysis with respect to any of the defendants on any of these particular issues. There wasn't any citation to the record. This is why the trial court found repeatedly that the defendants had failed to cite the record in their initial motion, that they hadn't taken the lights in the fact in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, that they hadn't done all of these other things. So I think that the context of this very lengthy, thorough decision provides what the district court here is doing is providing examples of misconduct. It does have the district court does have a conclusion that a jury can find that each of the defendants who are now here on appeal participated in the violation of McGuffin's rights. And in the context of this case and this type of an opinion, that's sufficient. And I also think that one other thing that is different.
It isn't sufficient. It may be sufficient for the first prong if they'd describe what they did to violate the rights. But the second prong, you've got to have a case that says that they were on notice that they shouldn't do it.
Absolutely.
For each one of these defendants.
Absolutely, Judge. And the
well, and it's not there.
Well, I respectfully disagree. So
well,
with
tell me, okay, let's move from Karcher, because I think Karcher's your best argument on the first prong. What about Oswald? What did Oswald do for fabrication?
Sure. So this is why, Your Honor. So there's additional evidence that's not mentioned in the district court's decision that we submitted at summary judgment below. And so, for example, part of our contention is that Oswald fabricated a report about the circumstances in which he found the shoe at Hudson Ridge. He claims improbably.
And the district court didn't rule on it?
The district court didn't mention it in his specific decision. And this goes to sort of how adjudication works. The defendants bore the burden initially at summary judgment. We put in all of this evidence. They didn't rebut any of it. They failed to do that. And so the district court issues a lengthy decision discussing examples of all of these things and in response to the motion that was filed. The issues that are presented here before this court about these four specific defendants are largely new arguments that were never made before the district court. And that's part of the difficulty we have with this appeal. The district court made findings of fact. It reviewed this voluminous record. Now the on appeal, they're saying we want a narrow focus on these four defendants and make arguments that we never made before. Ask the court, why didn't you point out this evidence? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do those things? The court was never asked to below. And so the record has shifted. The arguments have shifted, both with respect to Oswald, with Karcher, with some of these other defendants. So if you look at the opening brief here, and just going back to Karcher very briefly, there's all of these arguments about, well, this shows this. And it is a disagreement with the trial court, which they cannot do in this posture. And that's part of the big problem.
These are evidentiary factual issues, which are not appealable.
Exactly.
But we still have, on those, you still have to take a look at, if you have Karcher, is it your view that the entire appeal should be dismissed, or can we legitimately, especially with respect to this fabrication, separate out the defendants?
It's our view that the entire appeal should be dismissed because it, at core, is a challenge to the facts. And even the assertions of qualified immunity here are a challenge to the facts. So if you look carefully at the reply brief, the way that the defendants have framed the clearly established right at issue, the way that they're framing those issues is actually disputing the facts. For example, it's not undisputed in this record that Sweninger never spoke with Bryant. They're asserting that as truth. The district court didn't say that. We don't agree with
the district court didn't say anything. The district court only said, that's why I got to Sweninger. District court didn't say that Sweninger knew what Bryant would say. The district court said Sweninger knew that Bryant might have seen something or known something prior that might have been said that he might have testified wrongly, and he didn't do anything about it. That's all they said.
And those reweighing that evidence and asking whether the trial court should have cited more things from this 10,000-page record about that specific fact issue is exactly why this court lacks jurisdiction.
The problem comes, I gave every benefit of the doubt to the district court, and I said, supposing Sweninger knew Bryant had seen something that he could have swayed his testimony. He didn't know whether he was going to sway his testimony, and therefore, should he be in? And I said to myself, what Supreme Court precedent would I quote to say that should be in? What is it?
And I agree,
the district court didn't say, and I don't think you said.
And I agree, Your Honor, if the facts were that they had never spoken to this person and he didn't have the mens rea of knowing he was fabricating false evidence, I don't know that I have a case that says that. But this is actually not the fact that the district court found with respect to Sweninger. You know, the district court specifically found that a jury must decide whether he fabricated evidence by eliciting Bryant's false testimony. He pointed to evidence in the record that included Zanny's original report about the evidence. And there's another thing that's kind of missed in some of the briefing here that I wanted to point out. They convened what was called a hit team that had regular meetings, that shared information with one another. And that
is
had
that the cold case team?
Yeah. I mean,
you call it hit, but is that what I saw as a cold case team?
No, they called it the hit team. We had a broader group of people that were defendants in this case that were sued that we called the cold case investigators. They themselves called it the hit team. They were a group. They worked together and they wrote notes. And many of those notes were not turned over to the district attorney. For example, one of those notes, and this is how Sweninger and Zanny are tied together, has to do with Zanny's conversation with Bryant about this information. And then lo and behold, 10 years go by. And Bryant is not giving information that McGuffin specifically saw the body. Then, my stepdad called the current investigators, and now his testimony provides something. Mr. McGuffin saw the body. That links up with Karcher because she's the one providing false evidence that Mr. McGuffin was able to see the body from this embankment. These things work together and in tandem. So it really is, I understand, Your Honor, if it were something where we accepted the premise of the defendants that Mr. Bryant never spoke with Mr. Sweninger, there was no other information that Mr. Sweninger had about this other than one random phone call. Sure, there's not a Supreme Court case that says that. But that entire framework is a contest to the facts that were found here by the district court.
There is. The district court did make some findings about Schweniger interacting with the others, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Specific findings.
But yes, it's a circumstantial case about this witness who at the time was, of course, a teenager, I think, or very young, sort of being in the orbit of his stepfather and hearing he'd been at the party, so he was sort of talking very loosely about the facts of the case and so forth, right. And that was known. But that, you have to connect the dots. A fact finder would have to connect the dots for sure. I don't think there is any, if there is, I didn't see any direct evidence that anybody, any of the defendants knew that Bryant had either intentionally or sometimes unintentionally, you know, testified about this memory. So I'll grant you that, but I have another problem with Schweniger, which is the destruction of evidence claim against him. How did he what's the theory, factual theory, about him destroying evidence?
You're right, Judge. There's not specific evidence that we've identified with respect to Sweninger on this particular topic. But however, the problem
can we also throw Zanny into that too?
So
I'm going to ask you to take them one at a time.
Sorry.
But, well, I struggle. We've both got lots of, I think probably all of us.
We have a lot of
spreadsheets up here.
We want to let you answer the question.
Yeah. So just as for the moment, no, it's good to be well prepared. But for the moment, Schweniger, destruction, and you said what's the factual theory that he destroyed evidence?
So part of the issue here relates to the hit team's own reports and evidence that they themselves developed. We don't even have all of that. So I grant you that the destruction of evidence claim is most direct when it comes to Oswald and the other, the cigarette butts, the paper.
But if you could go back to Schweniger, what evidence was in the record, sir? What's the factual theory that Schweniger, because we do have jurisdiction to say if there's no evidence supporting a claim. And I don't even understand what the factual theory is.
That's right, Judge. There's no specific hard evidence that we're identifying with respect to Sweninger. However,
So what is the theory? How did he destroy evidence, please?
Sure. So the theory is that he is part of this conspiracy. He's a part of this multiple district agency working on all of these things. There are reports that have been never produced. And it's far be it from me to say that that's the theory of liability for him on that particular claim.
Okay, I know I'm cutting off, but yes, we've got to get to Zanny. But so,
well, ask you, is your bottom line that Schweniger's out on that claim?
No.
Okay.
Because he could still be liable for the conduct of
the conspiracy
of others as it relates to the others.
Okay, so that was my question. Your bottom line on him is that you're tasking him with the imputed liability for the actions of others in the conspiracy. Is that it?
On that particular claim, yes.
That's a yes.
Yes.
Okay. And then Judge Smith was valiantly trying to get you to answer the same question as to Zanny. I think.
Yes.
The answer would be the same.
Okay.
However, there are
findings as to him.
So
either.
Sorry, Judge.
No, you're okay. I'm just.
I think you're
to
the
say...
only one not interrupting, actually. So go right ahead, Judge Smith.
So With respect to Zanny, part of this has to do with a very long 10-year investigation covering a number of things, which is his role is involved. He's involved both in the beginning and in the end. When the hit team notes are created, when all of this other work happens. So I do think that the particular things that we could say, if you're looking for, what are the tangible things that you know exist that we say are of apparent value that were destroyed? It is the information that Oswald allegedly found next to the shoe. That's what he testified to in the deposition. And obviously this tape of the crime scene. And now what we're arguing is, and I think that we're on good ground arguing this, is that the doctrine of conspiracy yokes the other defendants. I think that's the language in some of the cases to that misconduct. And so that's the theory of liability.
When you say conspiracy and yokes the other defendants, Oswald was not in the cold case team.
He wasn't, right? So
he's not a part of their conspiracy because he wasn't even there.
Well, the evidence here, and I think the evidence that the district court found is sufficient for a jury to find that the conspiracy began shortly after the crime and continued through the duration. So there were some investigators.
I read it. They said there was a conspiracy when Roswald was involved, and then there was another at the cold case.
No, our claim is that it's one continuous conspiracy with involving
factual issue.
Correct.
That remains. Let me just skip to another point that we did ask the other counsel about, and that's the familial association. There is something kind of intuitively odd that you have such a familial association when the child wasn't born till 2007. I'm having a little trouble. Where is the clearly established law on that?
Sure, Judge. So this court has held since 1987 in Smith that there is a familial association claim between a parent and a child, and a child has such a claim that they can bring if the conduct is sufficiently egregious, whether it shocks the conscience or involves deliberate indifference, if there is time for deliberation.
But Smith, in footnote 12, Smith didn't quite have this circumstance, right?
For sure. And in footnote 12 of Smith itself, this court specifically went out of its way to say that the conduct doesn't need to be aimed at disrupting the relationship between the parent or the child, because it's the conduct itself, the badness of the conduct, that can have this consequence. So if you pair this idea with sort of general basic foreseeability principles like Monroe against Pape, 1961, a man is responsible for the natural consequences of his actions here. Putting somebody in prison for a crime that they didn't do is obviously foreseeable consequence of that is your relationships are going to be strained. And so that's in footnote 12 of Smith itself as it relates to that. And this court has specifically continued to recognize this right and its existence in other decisions after Glucksberg. I do want to mention, you know,
right expire then upon the release from prison? Is it?
What if he kept having children?
Yeah, what if he has 20 more children or adopts 15?
Oh, I see. Well, adopt doesn't count. This court has a case about that.
We do. If he has, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what's the temporal scope in addition to the substantive right.
I think that this is a unique application of this here because it's a wrongful imprisonment. And so we're interacting with other.
But the child didn't exist yet. She hadn't been conceived yet at the time. That's Judge McEwen's point. So we're trying to figure out where would it end? It would be quite different. And in our existing case law, if this person was wrongfully imprisoned in the way that, as Judge Smith said, is horrible, horrible, no question. But where would this right to a family member, you know, an afterborn child, where would that end?
Right. And so what I think that what I was going to say was sort of two other doctrines solve this. It's not the substantive right issue. The right is established in the case law that the types of worries that I think are at issue here are more about like whether there's a causation issue, secondary. And so, you know, if they were to argue, well, you know, we get the trial and they were like, we didn't even know that, you know, the daughter existed. And so how can you say that we're responsible for that? The judge would give an instruction on that. There's not a pattern in this circuit, but an instruction that includes causation. Then
that's
the jury,
if you got that far.
Would just exactly.
But
for
let me just ask you, as a practical matter, would it make any difference in your damages claims?
I think it matters, and it matters in a very real way. I appreciate the court's comments, which is that Mr. McGuffin's daughter's life has been entirely disrupted and upended by the absence of a father in her life. And that is something that, from the perspective of a child, that is a lot different than the you know, Mr. McGuffin saying, this was hard for me. You know, it was hard for her, and it continues to be, and how she maintains relationships and all of those things. So I do think it's a very serious claim. The other thing that I was going to say is that work here is because of Heck and the deferred accrual rules that apply here. That's why it seems a little bit more removed. In many other cases, it won't. But I do think that if you go back to their challenge here, and you look back at the summary judgment motion that was actually filed, the district court's decision here is above and beyond. It is beyond sufficient. It mentions all of the defendants in this particular case.
But you're out of time. Could you wrap up, please?
That was my wrap up. So we respectfully ask that this court would dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction or otherwise affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from opposing counsel. Oh, we're giving you 2 minutes. Come right on up. We took an awful lot of your time. So you're going to have to start.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
I guess the one thing that I would like to address really quickly is the refocus on the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis, because again, you know, I know there's been discussion by opposing counsel about the propriety of the motion and how those arguments went back and forth. But the reality of the scenario is that the plaintiffs have the burden to come up with that case law that puts each individual defendant on notice that the actual conduct they engaged in, not a giant umbrella, you shall not do, you know, violate someone's due process rights, but something specific. And again, that we don't have that here.
So your argument, I think, is that the defendants are arguing this Devereaux or the right to not be to suffer trial based on fabricated evidence is just too high a level generality, and there wasn't anything that put Kartra on notice, given her unique role, and that the same is true as to the other defendants.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. That there may be cases. Clearly, one of the cases that I, in preparing today, I ran across that plaintiffs had cited, I believe it was the Richards case. It's another Ninth Circuit case. That's the case where there was an investigator who, at least arguably, facts adopted on summary judgment record, had deliberately taken fibers from a suspect's clothing and put them under the fingernails, and there was color blood of
very
evidence that
case.
Happened.
Yeah.
Could be very different, and that may be one of those cases where that overarching right is enough. It makes it obvious enough. Mm-hmm. I posit that's not the case here. We have much more, much smaller, much more fine detail arguments that need to happen and case law that we need to see that would have put our defendants on notice.
Is that true of the failure to collect the evidence from the scene near the shoe?
Yes, that is also true. That is also correct. That's something that at most the argument, as I understand it from the plaintiffs, is that Officer Oswald was negligent in some manner in how he collected, preserved something, evidence, 10 years before there was ever a prosecution, and then we try to impute later on sort of association-based theories to keep him in.
So, thank you for your responses and for your advocacy, both of you. We appreciate it very much. We're going to take that case under advisement and go to the next case on the record, on the calendar.